The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Welcome, everybody, to our second installment now in Constitution Day. We are observing Constitution Day in the spirit of its legislative sponsor, Senator Robert Byrd, a distinguished graduate of this school who is the constitutional conscience of the Senate, and has made an extraordinary political odyssey in his life from once being a very conservative guy who actually was in the Ku Klux Klan all the way to being a progressive senator who stands up for constitutional rights and constitutional values at every turn. And so we're proud of him, and we're proud of the fact that for the first time we have a Constitution Day that is at least theoretically required for every educational institution in the country which receives federal funds. And so we are observing it in solidarity with this call. This session is about war powers today and the Constitution, and it's hard to think of two people who are better positioned to illuminate us on the subject. Main topic speaker is Professor Peter Irons, a professor of political science at the University of California at San Diego, who's the author of no less than 13 books, which I've just counted, including the famous People's History of the Supreme Court and May It Please the Court, which was a famous and controversial book when it first started, because essentially Peter liberated the oral arguments in the Supreme Court arguments from the Supreme Court, much to the chagrin of the late Chief Justice Rehnquist. His other books include one of my favorites, The Courage of Their Convictions, about people whose cases went to the Supreme Court, and his works have been praised throughout legal academia and throughout the worlds of historians and political scientists. Then we will have as a respondent my esteemed colleague, Dan Marcus, who's had an amazing career as a lawyer in law and government and public life for decades, a former partner at Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, former Associate Attorney General of the United States of America under President Clinton, and most recently, before coming to the Washington College of Law, the Chief Counsel of the 9/11 Commission. So Peter, we're going to start. We'll give you about 20 minutes, 25 minutes to do your thing. We'll have Dan go, and then we will open it up for discussion. Please welcome Peter Irons.
Well, thank you for that introduction, Jamie, and I do want to extend my gratitude for having been invited here for this first mandatory observance of Constitution Day. There will be a quiz at the end of the session. And I'm also honored to have some comments after I finish speaking from Dan Marcus, and who has promised to give me a few gentle jabs, as he said, about my book. But I also want to say what an honor it has been, particularly for those of you who were here for the first part of this presentation, to be here with Mary Beth Tinker, whom I first met in her kitchen in St. Louis, I think in 1987, when I was traveling around the country doing interviews for this book, The Courage of Their Convictions. And she was then and still is a charming, very articulate, and very principled person, and I'm very glad that she's here with us today. Now, Dan said that he's going to make a few gentle jabs at this book, which I am sure I can take with grace. But the book itself has been given some not-so-gentle jabs. There was a review in a newspaper that recently started in Washington called the Washington Examiner. Has anybody seen that paper? Apparently they drop it on your doorstep. It's free and worth what you pay for it. But at any rate, there was a review of the book, and the reason I'm starting out this way, there was a review of the book by Andrew McCarthy. And Andrew McCarthy was a former federal prosecutor. In fact, he prosecuted some of the defendants in the original World Trade Center bombing of 1993. He is, I think it's fair to say, fairly conservative on this issue, and here's what he had to say about the book, and I'm quoting verbatim. This is a truly bad book by a member of the lunatic left who holds the ludicrous theory that the framers actually meant what they said in the War Powers Clause. And he argued in his review that, in fact...
Peter, you understand that twice as many people just experienced that review than experienced it when it first came out.
Pardon me?
You've just doubled his audience.
At any rate, his argument is that, in a sense, the Constitution has become outmoded, a dead letter. That what the framers said more than 200 years ago in Philadelphia no longer has any relevance because we're living in a vastly different world, which of course is true. But the framers themselves, as I'm not sure you know, deliberately drafted a document that, as Chief Justice Marshall said, was designed to endure for the ages and has. Now, when the framers drafted the War Powers Clause in Section 8 of Article 1 of the Constitution, Congress shall have the power, among other things, of setting uniform weights and measures and establishing post offices and post roads and regulating commerce among the several states. The most awesome of these powers, of course, was the power to declare war, because there's no other event in a country's history that is as potentially costly and disastrous as going to war. But the framers were quite aware of the earlier experience where the British king had the untrammeled power to commit troops to war and, in fact, to send them to occupy other countries, and our colonies included, and they wanted to limit those powers. And they did so by placing the President of the United States directly under, subordinate to Congress in this area. The President, as you know, is in Article 2, is empowered to act as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. But I think it's important to understand that the early presidents, from George Washington all the way up to, but not including, James K. Polk in the 1840s, took this very seriously and did not engage the country in foreign adventures without very close collaboration and approval from Congress. All the wars that the United States was involved in, of course the only declared war, the War of 1812, but a number of other military actions, including the attacks on American shipping by the British and the French and the Barbary pirates, the early presidents understood that their powers were only those delegated by Congress, that their constitutional responsibility was to faithfully execute the laws. Well, as the country grew, and I'm not going to spend a great deal of time plodding through the history that the book recounts, but as the country grew, both in economic power, territorial reach, and ambition, there was a drive toward empire. Now, the word empire and the term imperialist have fallen into disrepute. We look back upon the earlier empires that all failed and collapsed over time, the British Empire, there all kinds of empires, from the Roman Empire down. But the United States really had a vision of a worldwide empire, not so much in terms of controlling territory the way the British and the Dutch and the French and the Portuguese and Spanish had done, but in terms of extending the influence of this country. The original vision, of course, Jefferson said this, was the empire of liberty, and which is a tremendous concept. But it became the empire of conquest. And in fact, the Supreme Court, in two opinions, Chief Justice Marshall, approved of the taking of territory by either, he said, conquest or treaty. And so we did in the Mexican-American War in the 1840s, deliberately instigate a war with a much weaker country solely for the purpose of taking their territory, the territory I now live in California, along with New Mexico and Arizona and Texas, simply taking it away by force. And I don't think there's any doubt about that among historians. This was not a war that was a defensive reaction to an invasion of our territory, but was instigated. And Congress responded to that. The House of Representatives passed a resolution condemning the president for what they called this unjust and unconstitutional war. And in fact, one member of the House of Representatives who voted for that resolution was Abraham Lincoln, who himself, as president, would engage in some highly extra-constitutional activities. Now, a big chunk of this book is about the civil liberties aspects of war powers. And it's tempting for me to dwell on those because, first of all, they're so relevant today. The recent decision of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in the Padilla case goes all the way back and is highly reminiscent, in fact, almost an exact parallel to the cases decided during the Civil War by the Supreme Court involving John Merriman and Lambda Milligan. And I'm going to quote briefly in a couple of minutes from the Supreme Court decision in the Milligan case, because I think that's something that John Roberts should be ordered to copy 100 times. I didn't hear, but Professor Raskin just told me about his dialogue with Senator Leahy yesterday about the war powers. And I think that it's still relevant today, more than a century and a half almost since the court decided the Milligan case. And I was involved personally in another wartime civil liberties case, war powers case, the case of Fred Korematsu, one of the great heroes in my life, one of the most wonderful people I ever met. I was honored to be his lawyer when he reopened in the 1980s the case in which the Supreme Court upheld, on the ground of military necessity, the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, and their detention, American citizens detained without charges, without access to counsel, without really any recourse to the judicial process. If that sounds familiar, it still is. Now, but I do want to point out something, going back to the Constitutional Convention, and quote from what James Madison said, because I think that's also highly relevant. And what Madison said in explaining why Congress had assumed the power to declare war, he said, "Those who are to conduct a war cannot be proper or safe judges whether a war ought to be commenced, continued, or concluded. They are barred from the latter functions by a great principle in free government, analogous to that which separates the power of executing from the power of enacting laws." Now, what the main thesis of this book is that over the past 50-some years, ever since 1950, when President Harry Truman sent troops into Korea, without a declaration of war by Congress, and in fact, really without the sanction of the United Nations, although he claimed to have that. It did not exist at the time that he sent the troops in, and Congress had not authorized under the UN the UN Participation Act of 1947 the special agreement that would have been necessary for Truman to do that. It was an entirely extra-constitutional action. But it set a precedent that later presidents eagerly grabbed on and have followed all the way through such relatively minor excursions as the invasion of that superpower, Grenada, in the Caribbean, which of course had threatened American security. I'm being totally facetious here. The invasion of Panama, under President Bush, all the way through the invasions of Afghanistan in 2001 and Iraq in 2003. Now, I want to very briefly point out that there's a difference, or there is alleged to be a difference, between a totally undeclared war. I think it would, even the State Department's legal advisor at the time, and I don't know if you know him, Dan, Abraham Sofair.
Yeah. I clerked with him, yeah.
You did. The State Department's legal advisor at the time of the invasion of Panama said, we cannot invade another country and overthrow its ruler simply because we don't like them, and that's not constitutional. But it was done, and Congress willingly abdicated its constitutional responsibility. But in the last two major invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, they were preceded by congressional passage of what were called authorizations for the use of force. There is an argument that these are what I call functional equivalents of a declaration of war. In other words, that they satisfy the constitutional requirement. After all, Congress says that the president may take all steps that are necessary and proper to safeguard the interests of the United States in those areas. And that, in effect, Congress has ratified those actions. And that, therefore, arguments that these are extra-constitutional or unconstitutional are beside the point. But I think, in a sense, that at least for me, as a constitutional fundamentalist, the topic of my next talk after this one is over, where I do talk about religious fundamentalism and the Constitution. It's sort of ironic, as a couple of reviewers of this book have pointed out, that I seem to be allied with people like Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, with whom I have nothing else in common, generally speaking, in holding to a what you might call an absolutist position on the War Powers Clause, almost like Justice Hugo Black. No law means no law, he used to say. Well, declare war means you have to declare war. And if you don't, then you're violating the Constitution. In my opinion, there is a strong case for originalism or original intent here, because the first of all, the intent is clear and unambiguous. And secondly, it should govern. If you're construing a very broadly worded phrase of the Constitution, like due process of law or equal protection of the laws, there is, as Justice John Harlan II said, this is an evolving process. You can't apply a single literal formula to interpreting those clauses, and they grow over time. I point out Justice Harlan because he was widely considered, rightly so, to be a very principled conservative who acknowledged that there had to be some latitude, room for growth, what Chief Justice Warren once called evolving standards of decency in interpreting the Constitution. But if the original intent of the framers is so unambiguous and clear, as I think it is in the War Powers Clause, then they should be held to it. And a part of the book is, in effect, a critique of the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts for abdicating their role by inventing or applying this doctrine of political question doctrine. That is, there's a dispute between two other coordinate branches of government, and they ought to fight it out among themselves and come to a political resolution. Congress, after all, does have the power to cut off funding for wars if it chooses to do so. Congress also has the ultimate power, of course, of impeachment if a president so egregiously commits high crimes and misdemeanors that warrant impeachment. Well, we know that Congress is congenitally incapable of taking such bold actions, and that the courts themselves have dodged these issues. So what it winds up being, I think, really is a matter, and this goes back to what Mary Beth was talking about and what she represents, of ordinary people, the American people, applying pressure on their elected representatives to reclaim their constitutional powers. Whether that will happen in the near future, I'm highly dubious. As I point out, the presidency is an institution, particularly since Franklin Roosevelt was president during the Great Depression and then during World War II, has become itself an imperial institution, vastly exceeding the resources available to Congress. One thing I pointed out in the book, which took about 2.3 milliseconds on Google to find out, was that the Defense Department and the other war agencies of our government, including the Office of Homeland Security, or Insecurity, whichever it is right now, have so far outstripped Congress in resources, their budgets are 100 times greater. And of course, Congress only devotes a small fraction of its own budget, $3 billion a year, to these issues of foreign affairs and war powers. So in a sense, members of Congress are at a considerable disadvantage. Also, the fact that the president and cabinet officers command the public media simply by virtue of their offices. The number of people who watch a televised presidential speech, such as the State of the Union address or the disunion address, vastly exceed those who stay glued to C-SPAN 24 hours a day. So what you see, in effect, is that one institution, one branch of government, has so far exceeded the others in influence and power that, in effect, they become subordinate, particularly in this area of foreign policy and war powers. Now, I want to end before Dan puts in his gentle jabs by putting in a few gentle jabs of my own at another law professor, someone who is actually, I haven't met personally, I will next month. We're going to debate this issue in Berkeley, of all places, where you can debate anything. Man named John Yoo, professor of law at Bolt Hall, the University of California, Berkeley. And John Yoo has written a book, and I have a pre-publication copy here. It won't be officially published until next month, called The Powers of War and Peace, The Constitution and Foreign Affairs After 9/11. And I don't know if you've seen this book, Dan, or read it. You'll find it fascinating, although it's a real law professor book. I mean, the footnotes are enough to choke a hippopotamus. But and it's basically put together, like many law professor books, cobbled together from previous law review articles, which he wrote well before 9/11. In fact, the subtitle of the book is highly misleading because it has absolutely nothing to do with the Constitution and foreign affairs after 9/11. And it's basically an academic treatise on the question of whether treaties are self-executing or non-self-executing, an issue in which I have no position because I know nothing about it. But John did say a few things in his book. And, of course, he became fairly well-known a year or two ago when the media got a hold of and published memoranda that he'd written as a member of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department under President Bush, arguing that the detainees at Guantanamo Bay and other places where American troops or the American government is holding alleged enemy combatants without access to trial, without access to counsel or charges indefinitely, perhaps for the rest of their lives. His argument was that we do not need to apply the provisions of the Geneva Convention, to which the United States is a signatory, to these people, because in fact they are not strictly speaking prisoners of war or civilians. They are in this limbo area, enemy combatants, a relatively new term. John makes a point. I want to quote just a couple of sentences from his book near the end when he does briefly discuss these issues. He says, with large militaries designed to project overwhelming force throughout the world at his disposal, the president as commander-in-chief holds the initiative to use force abroad. Congress can always cut off the funding for military adventures, which in the era of modern war maybe means simply refusing to appropriate new funds or constructing offensive weapon systems. This effective check on the president's power renders unnecessary any formal process requirement for congressional authorization or a declaration of war before hostilities may begin. Renders unnecessary any formal process requirement for congressional authorization, let alone a declaration of war, before hostilities may begin. Well, that to me is a chilling statement, but I think it's one that members of the present administration believe in and agree with and are operating under its premises, that they're not bound by any formal process before they can initiate hostilities anywhere in the world. And I think that's something we need to be concerned about. Now, I'm going to conclude by going back to 1866. And if I had a great deal of time, which I don't, I'd talk about the Civil War, civil liberties cases, and the recent civil liberties cases, Rasul versus Bush and Padilla versus Rumsfeld and Hamdi versus Rumsfeld, and even the recent case, the decision of the Fourth Circuit in the Padilla case overruling a federal district judge appointed by President Bush himself, that an American citizen cannot be indefinitely held without charges, any formal process or access to counsel. And this is what the Supreme Court said in 1866 in a case almost identical in facts to these enemy combatant cases involving an American citizen who was arrested by military officials in the state of Indiana, alleged to be a Confederate sympathizer and plotting to free Confederate prisoners from Union prisoner of war camps. The federal courts were open and functioning at the time in Indiana. It was not invaded by Confederate troops. It was not a true martial law situation. But he was tried by a military commission set up by President Lincoln and sentenced to die. A man named Lambton Milliken, sentenced to be hung. And his lawyers filed a habeas corpus petition, which went up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled unanimously. And the government lawyers, by the way, argued that the court did not have any jurisdiction to hear this case, the same argument that President Bush's lawyers are making today. And the Supreme Court said this: "The Constitution of the United States is a law for rulers and people, equally in war and in peace, and covering with the shield of its protection all classes of men at all times and under all circumstances. No doctrine involving more pernicious consequences was ever invented by the wit of man than that any of its provisions can be suspended during any of the great exigencies of government. Such a doctrine leads directly to anarchism or despotism, but the theory of necessity on which it is based is false. For the government within the Constitution has all the powers granted to it which are necessary to preserve its existence, as has been happily proved by the result of the great effort to throw off its just authority in the Civil War." And I think that those are prophetic words, about as prophetic as those I earlier quoted from Justice Jackson about the very purpose of a Bill of Rights was to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes of public opinion to place them beyond the control of majorities. They are subject to the outcome of no elections. So I think that in opening up this issue today, during a time when we are engaged in a war, which is becoming increasingly unpopular, when we have the experience of a government that has dissembled in its rationalization and justification for that war, and the experience of a Congress that willingly allowed this to happen, it's incumbent upon us to really think about these issues, because the next war might be right around the corner. And if we don't discuss and debate these issues, openly and freely and without fear, we may be condemned to repeat the lessons of history. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please welcome Dan Marcus.
Thanks. Well, I'll try to make a few comments on what Peter had to say and add a couple of thoughts of my own. I did tell Peter beforehand that I was going to make a couple of gentle jabs. He anticipated one of them, which is I do think there's a major difference between presidents I think there's a major difference between what President Truman did in the Korean War, where he acted without any authorization from Congress, and what Presidents Johnson in the Vietnam War with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and the two President Bushes did with the Gulf War and the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. By getting a resolution. I agree that there's an argument that there's not, that an authorizing resolution is not a declaration of war, but I do think their functional equivalence and their effect, certainly. Indeed, declarations of war typically are, if anything, give the president broader latitude than these authorizing resolutions that Congress passed. Now that I got my gentle jab out of the way, I wanted to add a few things. One small disagreement on the Padilla case, or as it's now being called, the Padilla case. I just learned this from Padilla's lawyer, who called him Padilla for the first couple of years. Then she finally met him, and he told her his name is Padilla. So the word is sort of getting around now, but the Padilla or Padilla case. I agree that the Fourth Circuit decision was to me a shocking decision, both because it was unanimous and it just gave sort of the back of the hand to pretty serious arguments on the other side. I do think it's likely that the Supreme Court will come out differently, but I can't resist saying that I do think there are distinctions between Milligan and Padilla. Mainly that Padilla is at least alleged to be an agent of a foreign entity that attacked the United States. Second, the Supreme Court has held in the Hamdi case that the president does have authority from Congress and I guess also constitutional authority to declare people in the war on terror to be enemy combatants and to detain them, subject to certain due process guarantees. Okay. I'm going to be a little of a Pollyanna on the issue of, I think Peter's book ends up fairly discouraged about the poor performance of both the courts and the Congress in upholding the war powers of Congress and in checking all these adventures by presidents, both Republican and Democratic. And I share his pessimism about Congress. I think Congress is the most dysfunctional of the three branches generally and has done a very poor job of checking presidents, even when presidential actions are unpopular, as in the case of the Korean War and the case of President Clinton's efforts in Bosnia and Kosovo. And I want to come back to the Kosovo thing because I think it's kind of an interesting case study. I think there's more hope for the courts. I base that on tying together a number of things, and maybe I'm being a little too hopeful here. One is, I think, and some of these things are bad in other contexts, but here they may be good. I do think There is a trend that we've seen over recent years. Indeed, a lot of liberal law professors have given speeches about the activist conservative Supreme Court that is arrogating to itself the final authority to determine not only constitutional issues, but whether there's a factual basis for congressional findings underlying statutes. But I do think there's a general trend to the Supreme Court insisting, as in the City of Bernie case and so on, that it has to be the final authority on all constitutional issues. Excuse me. And there's also been, over time, and this hasn't been a steady erosion, but I think if you look at the last 50 years, when there's been an erosion from the days of Felix Frankfurter, who was the chief inventor and apostle of the political question doctrine. There's been an erosion of the political question doctrine, starting with Baker versus Carr and lots of cases where the court is getting into areas which it previously would not have. And I think I take some encouragement from the Hamdi and Razul decisions, I think you do too, that the Supreme Court, even in this area of separation of powers and war powers, that the Supreme Court is not willing to give the president a blank check. And I think an interesting opinion that there was a very interesting debate in the D.C. Circuit a few years ago during the Clinton administration in a case called Campbell versus Clinton, where several congressmen tried to challenge the constitutionality and the legality under the War Powers resolution of President Clinton's continued bombing of, I guess he wasn't personally flying the planes, but his continued bombing of Belgrade because of the war of the Kosovo dispute. And it was this is the case I wanted to talk about a little, because I think it's an interesting case study. That this was at a time when President Clinton was at the nadir of his, well, maybe he wasn't at the nadir of his popularity. I forget whether it was before or after the impeachment trial, after he was acquitted. I don't know if anyone remembers, but in either event, he wasn't that strong politically. And the House of Representatives, which was controlled by conservative Republicans who hated anything that Clinton did, conspired to undermine him with respect to the bombing of Serbia. The Republicans introduced a resolution to declare war, confident that they would defeat that resolution and embarrass the president. And that's what happened. The resolution to declare war on Yugoslavia or Serbia, whatever it was called at the time, was overwhelmingly defeated. And then there was another resolution to approve of the bombing that was, and I don't recall whether it was a genuine resolution introduced by the Democrats as a countermeasure or by the Republicans to embarrass Clinton some more. It also failed by a tie vote. Then the Democrats, some Democrat, or maybe it was a Republican, introduced a resolution to disapprove of the bombing, and that was defeated also. Clinton was, you know, the net result of this, and the Senate didn't do anything. This was all political monkey business and mischief-making. But the net result of that was Clinton was free to do whatever he wanted to. The case was brought by a number of congressmen. The D.C. Circuit unanimously threw it out on standing grounds. But then Judge Silverman and Judge Tatel had a wonderful debate in unnecessary concurring opinions, since they had thrown the case out on, they'd all agreed nobody had standing to bring this case, on the political question doctrine. But they also got into the merits a little. And my hunch is Judge Silverman couldn't resist writing, who is the sort of apostle of presidential power, couldn't resist writing this opinion, which said this is a political question, you know, because there are no discernible standards and it's committed to the president and lots of other reasons, I'm sure. And he said, anyway, The president has very broad power in this area, and he talked about repelling invasions and how in the modern world the president had to be able to do all these things. Tatel, in an interesting concurring opinion, because he also agreed that plaintiffs didn't have standing, said, hey, you know, we don't believe in the political question doctrine so much anymore. And what is this nonsense about how courts can't decide whether there is a war that requires, under the Constitution, a declaration by Congress? And he cited the prize cases during the Civil War, which I think were private litigation about damages from ships that had been seized during the Civil War. And he said, look, you know, the Supreme Court decided whether there was a state of war at that time for purposes of adjudicating that case. It's not harder than anything else courts do. And who better, he said, to referee disputes between Congress and the president? You know, that's the role, one of the important roles of the Supreme Court ought to be to referee disputes between the Congress and the president, as it did in this, in Youngstown and other cases. Anyway, if anyone wants to look at that case, it's 203 F3rd 19. And so I think Tatel's opinion reflects perhaps, along with these other general factors I've cited, maybe we can hope for a greater willingness of the courts to take on some of these issues. Now, as I said to Jamie and Peter before, you know, if we get Roberts on the Supreme Court, which looks pretty likely, and if the president then listens to all the liberal Democrats and puts Gonzalez on the Supreme Court, we may have two more strong advocates of executive authority. Let me say one other thing that I think has occurred to me this morning that I think has played a role in this area. You know, as Peter Irons' book shows, for at least the first part of our nation's history, presidents did take seriously this business of Congress having a role, having the key role in initiating war. And I was asking myself this morning, why is it that we all have this notion, which I think we're starting to shed somewhat as we have wars we don't like, that the president is the guy? You know, the president is the guy for foreign policy, the president is the guy for war, and it's a good thing that that we have this strong presidency now. And I think part of it is for the older generation, like Irons and me. you know, we grew up in an era where our parents and the academic world worshipped Franklin Roosevelt. And one of the themes of the academic establishment at the time was, wasn't it terrific that to deal with all the problems of the modern world, whether it's depression or the Nazis or whatever, that we have now evolved this strong presidency? And Arthur Schlesinger wrote his influential books, and was it Clinton Rossiter? I can't remember. He wrote a book about the presidency that we all read in college, and I think he was an advocate of a strong presidency. I may have that wrong. I'm glad to see Lubbers is nodding his head yes. So we all grew up thinking, you know, Congress is bad, president is good. I think the Vietnam War changed that for a lot of us. The other thing that I think has, in the legal establishment, here's my new theory, in the legal establishment, I think one of the things that has promoted this notion of the primacy of executive power in these areas is the fact that in both Republican and Democratic administrations, all the hotshot young lawyers, the Supreme Court clerks and so on, take jobs in the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department, or the White House Counsel's office, where they are, like John Roberts, inculcated in this very strong view about the primacy of executive power. And I think that that has sort of fostered this view that, and when you combine that with the stuff that, that Peter talks about in his book that we have to deal with now, which is in the modern world, war is a little messier than it used to be. It's not as neat as it was in the days of the founding fathers when you had time to consider these issues because, you know, it took 2 weeks for the battleships to get across the ocean. You knew when one nation was at war with another, and it was all done in a very formal way. I think that's one thing that perhaps I think you could have, you might have addressed more in your book, if I'll, third and last gentle jab, that everyone agrees that there's a difference between declaring war, that even though Congress has the power to declare war, even Professor Irons agrees that when the United States is attacked by somebody, that the president may need to take immediate action to repel that attack and that you don't need congressional authorization to do that. But in the modern world, you have all this murky stuff about when are we being attacked. Is it an attack on the United States when Al-Qaeda bombs U.S. embassies in East Africa in 1998? Is that an act of war? It's not an attack by a state on the United States. It's an attack by a group. It's not an attack on our territory. And I think a lot of the scholars on the original understanding of the Constitution would say that that's different. That's not what the framers were thinking about, was the president having to do something about somebody coming into the United States and attacking us. If the British snuck in from Canada or something. I think the issue in the age of the war on terror, the question of what kinds of defensive actions can the president take, and how long can those continue? When is the emergency over? When does it switch from defense to offense? Something that I haven't had occasion to get into very much myself. I'm not an expert on military law and the war powers. But I think that is a very tricky area. If I can, I don't know how much time I have. I have another few minutes. Tell you an interesting story from my experience as general counsel of the 9/11 Commission. We had one of our brightest and most imaginative commissioners and eccentric at times was Bob Kerry, the former governor of Nebraska, senator from Nebraska, who now finds himself as the president of a famous left-wing university in New York. Great story. Kerry hosted one of the commission hearings at the New School in New York, and all the commissioners were up there, and he had a dinner for us in this beautiful room in the New School. And so all these conservative Republican commissioners, you know, it was five Democrats, five Republicans, walk into this room, and there's this Diego Rivera mural on the wall with Lenin and Marx. Kerry's view was that President Clinton in 1998, when the Al-Qaeda attacked the U.S. embassies in East Africa, should have viewed that as an act of war, should have either asked Congress for a declaration of war, or should have, I don't know that Kerry ever said that he should have asked for a declaration of war, because his main thesis was that the president should act even if, because people always said, with respect to 9/11, and I believe this, the only person I've met who doesn't believe this is Bob Kerry, people always say, until, and officials from both Clinton and Bush administrations said, until 9/11, the American people and the Congress would not have supported an invasion of Afghanistan in response to attacks abroad by al-Qaeda. And I think that's right. Kerry doesn't think that's right. He thinks that if the president, if Clinton and Bush had shown a little leadership, like Clinton did in Bosnia and Kosovo, whereas Kerry says, you know, if he had gone to Congress and asked for a declaration of war, he wouldn't have gotten it. But by acting in as he did, he did the right thing, and the American people eventually supported him. And he thinks that's what should have been done after the attacks on the East Africa embassies. Now, one of the reasons I mention all this is I assume that the justification in for what we did in Bosnia and Kosovo without any congressional authorization was that we were acting as part of NATO and pursuant to a decision by NATO under a treaty to which we are a party, which was ratified by the Senate, to commit troops for military action. And I think that's another area which I don't really know the answer to, if there is one. I don't think there is any answer. But I take it that, and here's a question for you, Peter. I take it would be your view, I assume from reading your book, that even if we have a treaty like NATO or CETO, which I take it, and I haven't looked at the treaties, does oblige the United States, let's take the NATO treaty, the original NATO treaty during the Cold War, I believe obliged the United States as a matter of international law to go to the defense of any NATO country that the Russians attacked, that the Soviet Union attacked. And I take it that the UN treaty, the UN treaty that that Senate approved, provided that this sort of second bite for Congress, that if the Security Council authorized action, that that Congress would still have to approve the thing, and that was Truman's sin in the Korean War, was not going to Congress to get that approval. I wonder whether I don't know whether the NATO and similar treaties had provisions like that, but assuming they did not, I think it's an open question if by the constitutional process the Congress, through the Senate, ratifies a treaty which obligates the United States to commit troops for certain purposes in the future, you know, with a condition subsequent, like the Soviet Union invading their country, Is a declaration of war required in that case? I assume the answer is yes.
Yeah, I think the answer is yes. But it's a very good it's a very good question, and in fact, that's one of the central questions addressed by Professor Yu in his book, you know, which I think I disagree with him, but he makes probably the best case you can for the position that these are not self-executing treaties and that we can...
That they are, rather.
Pardon me?
That they are.
I mean, that
they are
self-executing
yeah.
treaties. Of course, this you know, we've been bound by treaties before. One of the first episodes I talk about in my book is President Washington's abrogation, really, of the Franco-American treaty. To what extent these treaties actually bind the United States to come to the defense of an ally who's being attacked or invaded, and whether in fact that requires a congressional declaration of war. But one thing that the UN Participation Act does, and I'm not an authority on NATO or CETO or CENTO or any of the other O's, is that it requires what's called a special agreement passed by Congress. And it's interesting because the person who was, I think, most responsible, two people in the Senate at the time, most responsible for inserting this provision, it came as an amendment which says, within the constitutional processes of the United States, troops can be committed, which, of course, assumed a declaration of war, were two very conservative Republicans, Senator Arthur Vandenberg of Michigan and Robert Taft of Ohio. And unlike you, I think, I grew up in a staunchly Republican family in Ohio. My father was a great admirer of Senator Taft. And I just want to quote one sentence from what Taft said during the debate on this during the Korean War. And he says, if the president can take the country to war in Korea without congressional approval, he can go to war in Malaya or Indonesia or South America or Iran.
Yeah.
Very prescient.
Yeah. Okay, well, I guess we ought to get questions for Professor Irons.
Terrific.
Right?
Thank you very much, Dan.
I don't have
this. All right, so we're going to open it up now. We've got several minutes for questions for Professor Irons or for Professor Marcus.
I do want to point out, if I could, that in about, 25 minutes or so?
Yeah.
We are all going to morph and begin a discussion of religion issues. I hope as many of you as possible can stick around for that. But I do want to, as a preview of coming attractions, say that I'm going to try to draw a parallel between these two, or at least some connections between these two hopefully will be somewhat provocative.
Peter has written a new book about...
It's not yet written.
Oh. Peter's about to write a new book about church, state, religion, and politics in America today.
Called God on Trial.
What's
it? But one thing I failed to mention, Peter, correct me if I've got my history wrong, but I recollect from one of your books you're telling the story of how you actually... you weren't quite in Mary Beth's situation. Your case never went to the Supreme Court, but that you were a draft resister, or you attempted to be a conscientious objector during Vietnam and took the position that the law was unconstitutional because it confined the conscientious objector status to people who were acting on a religious principle.
Almost right. Actually, it predated my draft resistance, predated Vietnam. It came out of my involvement with the sit-in movement in 1960, mm-hmm. when I was challenged at the very first National SNCC Convention in Atlanta by a remarkable guy named James Lawson, who was expelled from a Baptist seminary for leading sit-in demonstrations. And he said, you know, you have to take a stand whether you're going to participate in this system of apartheid, and the only visible symbol I had was my draft card, which I sent back to the draft board. But I never did claim conscientious objector status, mm-hmm. Deliberately, because I felt that the provision in Section 6J of the Universal Military Training and Service Act, which says to become a conscientious objector, you must swear that you have a belief in God superior to that arising from any human relationship. First of all, I didn't believe that, and secondly, I didn't think it was any of their business. And I went to trial before a federal judge who had a son in Vietnam at the time, argued with him about constitutional law, which was a big mistake, cited a case called Torcaso versus Watkins to no avail. He sentenced me to 10 years in federal prison.
The Seeger case had not been decided yet?
The Seeger case had not yet been decided, mm-hmm. and the Welch case had not yet been decided. I ultimately prevailed, by the way, although, of course, and the judge cut the sentence down to 3 years, and I served that.
You served all 3 years?
All 3 years, mm-hmm. Which I'm very proud of, as a matter of fact. But I like to say that I'm one of the few Harvard Law School graduates who went to prison before law school. But at any rate, I'm glad you brought that up, because it has a lot to do with why I do what I do, why I seek out people like Mary Beth Tinker and other people, why I represented Fred Korematsu, why I take the positions I do. And I think that Dan said something very interesting that I hadn't even thought of, which was that we all go through socialization processes, starting with kindergarten, even before, and you're going through one right now, law school. But the socialization process of people, bright young law graduates who go into federal service, particularly in places like the Office of Legal Counsel and the White House Counsel's Office.
Solicitor General's Office.
And the Solicitor General's Office, does, and I hadn't even thought about this, socialize them into a mindset and a culture that stresses executive power over congressional power. And it's interesting, I think, that most of the people, and you know a lot more about this than I do, who work for congressional committees when they come out of law school as counsel or staff, are, in a sense, maybe predisposed, but also socialized in a different respect.
Yep.
And it'd be an interesting project for somebody, law review article type of stuff.
It certainly had an impact on Scalia and Rehnquist, right? They were both head of the OLC.
Yep. Stand up. Or you can come to the microphone down here if you don't mind. Then we can pick it up for our podcast. Whatever that is.
Well, it's a good question, which hasn't been answered yet. And I think that, first of all, the federal courts do have and should have the power to decide whether such authorizations meet the constitutional requirement, which they may do. The courts may do that. But there were some very courageous federal judges during the Vietnam War who addressed these issues, particularly the standing of members of Congress to challenge presidential exercises such as the bombing of Cambodia. The book, incidentally, is dedicated to one of my heroes, Representative John Conyers of Michigan, whom I met back in 1964 when he was first elected to Congress, and he's now the second longest-serving member of Congress and has been a consistent advocate for all kinds of good things ever since then, including the war powers issues. But I don't think, and I don't know if Dan would agree or not, that there really is a distinction between a declaration of war and an authorization. Hamilton, did make it clear that in one of the Federalist Papers he said authorization or declaration. And so that might be the case. In other words, the invasion of Afghanistan or Iraq might not be, strictly speaking, unconstitutional. But that's a question that has not yet been decided by the courts.
It's an interesting question because I think from the standpoint of the if a lawsuit were filed, you couldn't say that the president was acting unlawfully because Congress would either he had the inherent authority to do it or Congress has authorized him to do it. But I suppose that somebody who, if a latter day Peter Irons got drafted to fight in the war in Afghanistan or the war in Iraq, I thought from your previous answer you would say, assuming a court would adjudicate that case, that he could argue that it was that the war was unconstitutional because Congress had not declared war, that the authorizing resolution is not a declaration of war, and even though the two things might say the same thing, Congress has to say the magic words, right?
Yeah.
I think that's pretty silly, but that's what I think you could argue.
If that's the only way you can stay out of jail, yeah.
Peter, what about the claim that's often made that Congress has the power to declare war, but the implied constitutional premise is that the president can wage war when he needs to or when he wants to, which is the most ambitious statement of the counterproposition, that the power to declare war is just a purely formal power, but the substantive power to wage it and execute it belongs to the president.
But I don't think anybody seriously takes that view, do they? I mean, I don't even think that the Office of Legal Counsel would say that the president could launch a truly offensive war without authorization from Congress.
Yes, they have.
Well, I think that they would say they would turn somersaults to find that what he's doing is within the president's power to respond to attacks on the United States, for example. In the Clinton administration, the bombing of the launching of cruise missiles to try to get bin Laden in Afghanistan after the attacks on the embassies and the cruise missiles going to
Sudan
to knock out the
Monica Lewinsky coverage.
The
Monica Lewinsky coverage.
We found in the 9/11 Commission that it wasn't there was no effect of the Monica Lewinsky thing on the decision making in the executive branch, but everybody thought there was. That was justified by the National Security Council legal advisor and by OLC as a response to an attack, as self-defense. And indeed, we found there was this. This is a slight correction of something you say in your book. We found in the when we finally got to see all the legal documents about covert action authority in the during the Clinton administration and after 1998, that Clinton did finally authorize a covert action whose aim was to kill bin Laden rather than just to capture him. And, well, of course, he might be killed in the process. And that was also justified on this responding to an attack thing. So maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know that I would be surprised if OLC, have they really said that?
Well, no, they said that in the sense, because you know, I said no. I mean, I said yes, they had before you finished talking. I interrupted you, which my daughters always point out is rude. What they've done, of course, in very lawyerly fashion is to radically redefine the concept of self-defense.
Right, right.
But, you know, anything that we do, since we are now under global attack for an indefinite period of time, anything we do in response is self-defense.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's the theory, yeah, and it is a very disturbingly broad theory. Here's an interesting question that I wonder if you would comment on. I think you touch on it in your book, or anyone in the audience, and that is, it's kind of unanswered. The Constitution talks about who starts a war. Congress declares war. Constitution, and that the President, everyone agrees, once Congress declares war, he's in charge of conducting the war. What about stopping the war?
That came up yesterday. Between Leahy and Roberts.
Oh, did it?
There
yeah.
was a long colloquy about
in
that.
In other words, can Congress, and this, you talk about one of the Cambodia bombing thing was sort of like this. Could Congress tomorrow pass a law requiring the President to stop the war in Iraq? Now, we all know that they could sort of do it indirectly by cutting off funds or something like that, but that's kind of... could they pass a law? A similar issue came up. I don't think the Supreme Court's ever spoken to this, but they did speak... I think they spoke to a similar issue with respect to treaties, and that is it's very clear under the Constitution how you make a treaty. The President enters into it, and then it's not effective until the Senate ratifies it. But can the President unilaterally revoke a treaty? And I think the Supreme Court said yes, right? Did they, Herman?
Political question.
There's this funny case. Professor Schwartz, probably.
Political question. But
yeah.
You don't have a majority.
Yeah.
Plus power.
But the Supreme Court has said, and I don't know if this is analogous or not, that the requirement that the Senate ratify, the Senate approve presidential nominees doesn't mean the President can't fire somebody without the agreement of the Senate, right? But that's different.
Yeah, that's the Humphreys case. It's interesting, though, that there was a case, I don't recall the title, but it involved the Migratory Bird Treaty between Canada and the United States.
Missouri against Holland, yeah.
Missouri against Holland, okay. In which some of these issues came up, but that's the extent of my knowledge.
Herman, why don't we give you one final comment, and then...
I can't hear him.
Yeah.
Herman, Professor Schwartz, would you be kind enough to come to the microphone just so everybody can hear?
I don't think the mic is on.
There he is. Yeah. Yes.
Very different considerations. The court has already said that the AUMF,
yeah,
in effect, allows the President to do any damn thing he pleases, up to citizens. I don't think we have that kind of resolution.
Also, the notion that the President's actions there were in response to an attack on the United States are a little bit stronger there.
Any final comments before we break from this panel?
I'm ready.
All right, let us thank Professor Peter Irons, Professor Dan Marcus for their wonderful presentation. We will just take a quick 4 or 5 minute break. We will resume at 1:30 with the panel discussion about church-state in America today. So come right back and stay tuned.